Hi everyone, I'm Dr. Sanjeev Goyal, and you're listening to the Peak Human Advanced Anti-Aging and Technology Summit. Today I'm interviewing Dr. Lucia Aronica. Dr. Lucia Aronica is a lecturer at the Stanford Prevention and Research Center, genomics lead at Metagenics Incorporated, and editor of the peer-reviewed journal by MDPI. Her research investigates how diet, genetics, and epigenetics interact with each other to impact our health and longevity, and how to use this information to design personalized lifestyle interventions. She's an acclaimed speaker and serves as an advisor for companies active in the personal genomics and precision health field. Dr. Aronica received her PhD from the University of Vienna and has research experience from the University of Oxford, University of Southern California, and University of Federico II of Naples. She has published research papers in top-ranked peer-reviewed journals such as Cell, Genes in Development, and the EMBO Journal. I hope you enjoyed today's talk with her.
Hi, everyone. I'm Dr. Sanjeev Goyal, and you're listening to the Advanced Anti-Aging and Technology Summit. And today, my guest is Dr. Lucia Aronica. How are you, Lucia?
I'm great, Sanjeev. Thank you very much for having me.
I'm so excited to have you. I just heard your talk to the Academy of Anti-Aging Physicians, and I thought it's very important for our viewers to listen to what your expertise on this topic. So first, if you can tell us, how did you get into the field of epigenetics? What was really, why did you feel this is something you wanted to devote your life to?
Yes, so my interest for epigenetics is a love story between food and science. I was born in Italy, where we value food as medicine, and I decided to study epigenetics, which was at that time in the early 2000s an emerging science. And epigenetics, then the study of epigenetics, really showed me how actually lifestyle can become biology. And so I think epigenetics is the ultimate science for the biohackers out there, because it provides a molecular explanation as to why actually our life exposures and actions can turn into biology, thus impacting our health span and lifespan. And I've been dedicating the past 15 years of my career to this field. I first did my PhD studies in epigenetics at the University of Vienna. At that time, I was studying one epigenetic modification called small RNAs. And then I did a postdoc at Oxford University on another epigenetic modification called histone modifications. And finally, I came to Stanford to study yet another epigenetic modification, DNA methylation, and its role in basically lifestyle medicine. Specifically, I'm looking at how DNA methylation changes after a lifestyle intervention involving a low carb and a low fat diet within the Diet Fits clinical trial. This is the largest ever undertaken randomized clinical trial looking at weight loss and other disease risk biomarkers during the course of an intervention, a one-year intervention with either a low carb or a low fat diet.
Oh wow, that's very exciting. Let's definitely get into that. But before we do, if you can just tell our viewers what is, like, if you can explain epigenetics a little bit more in broad terms so they can get their heads around it, that'd be very helpful.
Yes. So epigenetics, epi means on the top. So on the top of our genes, there are molecular marks called epigenetic marks. And these marks act like a switch for genes. They can turn genes on and off. And this can explain remarkable differences in the way our cells look and perform, even without causing any genetic changes. And that's why I told you before, epigenetics is the ultimate science for biohackers. It can explain why, even if you don't change your genetics, you through lifestyle, you can change your biology. Because these switches, unlike genes, these switches dynamically respond to lifestyle. And that's why you can think of your DNA as hardware, and your epigenome, the entire set of your epigenetic marks, as software that you can reprogram through your lifestyle choices and life exposures. I mean, the power of epigenetics is so powerful that, for example, epigenetics can explain why you have the same DNA in each cell of your body, and yet every single cell looks different from each other. So you have brain cells and skin cells that have the same genetic information, the same hardware, but because they each use a different epigenetic software to tell the cell which genes to turn on and off, they look so different from each other. So that's so profound.
That's telling us that most everything we're seeing is not at the DNA level, it's at the epigenetic level. Most of the phenotype is related to the epigenetic.
Yes, and of course, epigenetics is not the only lifestyle omics to explain why, you know, so genomics is set in stone. Our genes, we can change our genes. But then there are other omics called collectively lifestyle omics, which can explain why the lifestyle can actually change our biology. And these are epigenomics, microbiomics, proteomics, and metabolomics. And these omics together explain why, you know, lifestyle can become biology and affect our health.
Mm-hmm. So let's just, you were mentioning these epigenetic modifications, and one of your study right now is looking at methylation, but you did mention two other types of modifications. So if you could just kind of just run through them in categories and why, how do these modifications impact how the output is, which I guess is the proteins, and all that, that'd be very helpful.
Yes, sure. I will start with DNA methylation because it's the focus on my studies now, and it is the best studied modification, especially for lifestyle interventions, and for a reason. Because we have the technology to measure DNA methylation at high resolution and in a very accurate way. So we can really tell you how much a gene is methylated at on which nucleotide precisely before and after a lifestyle intervention. And DNA methylation is the addition of a methyl group to the DNA itself, and specifically on the cytosines. So your DNA is made of four nucleotides, and cytosine is one of these nucleotides, and cytosines that are in the context of CG dinucleotides. So there are these cytosine and guanine dinucleotides in your DNA, and when the cytosine is methylated, this is called DNA methylation. So basically, DNA methylation is the methylation addition of a methyl group to your DNA itself. Then we have histone modifications. Histone modification can be histone methylation, phosphorylation, ubiquitination, the phosphorylation. There are so many different marks that are put on the histones. What are histones? Histones are proteins that help coil the DNA inside your cells so that the DNA becomes compact, that it can fit the cell nucleus. But at the same time, it's accessible. It's compacted in an organized way so that you know, the cell knows which genes are located where, so the cell machinery can access those genes and turn them on or off. And actually, histones are so important because the reason why a gene is off is because it's so coiled with histones, it's so tightly coiled with histones that a gene cannot be open and read by the cell machinery. So histones can control the opening of and closing of the chromatin, so to make to turn genes on and off.
And it sounds like that really that is the main mechanism of manipulating how histones impact off of making genes go off and on through. Yeah. It sounds like through methylation is one of those ways that histones are being changed. Is that correct?
Yeah. So exactly. So the opening and closing of the chromatin is the gateway to gene expression, is the mechanism of epigenetics. You can regulate that either by directly methylating the DNA, because then when you methylate the CGs, the effect is that you recruit some reader protein that read the DNA methylation modification and open the chromatin there. So it's a signal for the cell to tell, come here and read me, or come here and shut me down and close the chromatin. Or you can modify the histones, and by putting these marks on the histone, histone modification, you achieve two outcomes. The first outcome is that you can affect directly the opening and closing of the chromatin by affecting the electrostatic binding between histones and DNA, because histones are positively charged and the DNA is negatively charged. So when you modify histones, you directly affect this binding and opening. And then on the top of that, like with the DNA methylation, the histone modifications work as a docking site for reader protein that comes and open or close the chromatin. And then the third mechanism are small RNAs. And these are very complicated topics. I will briefly just say that small RNAs are an exciting way of regulating the epigenome.
MicroRNAs?
Yes. So I'm using small RNAs because it's a broader term. Small RNAs does include microRNAs, which are the human version. Then there are, I was working on other small RNAs that are called in another way. But anyway, small RNAs and microRNAs are an example of small RNAs. And why they're so exciting? Because these are basically mobile epigenetic marks. You can think of them like that, because the small RNAs are actually, they can shuttle between the cytoplasm and the nucleus. And so they are mobile. It's not like the DNA methylation or histones, they are just around the DNA. And what they do, they help target either especially histone modification to specific loci. Because if you think about it, how can a cell know where you are going to modify histones and how? Small RNA do that. So they can signal like the DNA methylases, the writer enzymes, the enzymes that write epigenetic modifications on your genes. They can act as a signal and say, come here and methylate this gene or unmethylate this other gene. So this is a little bit the function of small RNA. The second function is to another mechanism. So this is called transcriptional gene silencing, which means they affect whether a gene is transcribed or not, on or off. Or the small RNA can also do something else, which is called post-transcriptional gene silencing, and is also known as RNA interference. And this is another epigenetic mechanism by which actually the small RNA directly target the destruction of the mRNA, the messenger RNA, after its production. So after transcription, you produce an mRNA, and then this is destroyed the post-transcriptionally by small RNA. And this is called post-transcriptional gene silencing. It's perhaps too much detail, but I think it's an exciting field.
No, that's a very good field to hear that, because it's always more complex. The more you dig, the more complexity there is. So let's now that you've kind of said, okay, that this DNA methylation is a marker of, you know, as a way for the modifications to happen epigenetically, and then this determines expression of what turns out to be our phenotype, the way we look in our characteristics. And this, because lifestyles, you mentioned diet. But before we get to how we modify it, so generally this is, the methylation is happening as we get older. I think we'll be talking a little bit about these epigenetic clocks, that just living is causing a methylation, like just living, and there's a certain amount of that is happening no matter what we want to do. Is that correct?
Yes. So let me go back. So methylation is a physiological process. It's happening always, and actually it's a good thing that it's happening. If without methylation, we couldn't live. So sometimes I get this question, is there a good methylation and a bad methylation? Actually, I wouldn't say that. I would say that methylation is always good, but when it goes wrong, it becomes bad. So it's, as you pointed out, with aging, what happens is that we have aberrant methylation. Not only methylation, in general, we have aberrant epigenetic changes. Because one important thing to just highlight here, we have seen that methylation is only one little component of epigenetics. We have acetylation, phosphorylation, so many modifications, small RNAs, but you know, all these epigenetic modifications, including methylation, get a little bit, start to not working properly with age. And that's why epigenetic alterations are one of the main hallmarks of aging. Mm-hmm. And now it turns out that because we can now measure epigenetics and DNA methylation so precisely, in the last year, many so-called epigenetic clocks have been developed that are based on DNA methylation and can measure your DNA methylation to estimate your age. And this is called biological age, so the age of your tissues and cells. And fascinatingly, this biological age can deviate from your chronological age. So you can be actually biologically younger or older than your chronological age. And we now see that this reflects also your lifestyle and life exposures.
Mm-hmm. So that's very interesting. If we can just talk about some of these clocks, the first generation, second generation.
Yes. There are so far there have been 13 published clocks, DNA methylation clocks, and I'm sure there are many more under development now. So by now, this information that may be outdated. I think the epigenetic clocks capture two different type of information. We have seen chronological age and biological age. And you have mentioned the first generation and second generation clocks. Mostly the first generation clocks were trained to predict chronological age. And so I think the gold standard for estimating chronological age is so far the Horvat clock 2013, which has a correlation with the chronological age of, I think, 0.97 or something. So it's very, very precise estimating chronological age. But then, if you think about it, how useful is it to estimate chronological age? We already have passports for that, right? So it can be very useful for forensic applications, for sure. You can really precisely track the age of a forensic sample, for example. But for us biohackers, probably we are more interested in estimating biological age and how we can actually become biologically younger when we improve our lifestyle. And for this purpose, the second generation clocks are probably, are better options. At least they are aiming at estimating biological age, but they are focusing on biological age, and specifically really defining what biological age is. Like, biological age is actually a composite measure of different changes. You can have, for example, health. So it's a measure of health, but you can have changes that explain, for example, whether your cells are become senescent. Mm-hmm. Should we redo this part?
No, it's perfect. I'm just
okay.
That was excellent.
Yeah. No, I was wondering about these noises, but. So the second generation clocks instead are focusing on capturing biological age. Specifically, a recent paper by Morgan Levine described how we can actually deconstruct the various epigenetic clock to understand which epigenetic signals are captured by single clocks and which of these signal explain differences in biological age and which type of biological age. For example, we have some second generation clocks that are better predicting cancer, the correlation with the cancer progression or the cells. Or some other clocks are better estimating cell senescence. Other are better at estimating mitochondrial dysfunction. All these features are important processes in biological age. So even biological age is not one single entity. For these reasons, there's not a one-size-fits-all epigenetic clock. There's not such a thing. Actually, epigenetic clocks are a composite measure of biological age, and they also, of course, correlate strongly with the chronological age. And I think the future, the way forward, is really to develop like clocks that are focused on a subset of epigenetic signals that reflect specific biological processes connected with age. May that be cancer, cell senescence, mitochondrial dysfunction, because I think these are the tools that we will need for precision medicine. We know that, you may have actually a very strong mitochondrial function, but you may be starting developing some cancer cells. And these are two different things. And
completely separate. That's what I was curious about, is that we have, somebody could have, do very well on one particular score. I've seen like athletes come back with, in 5 years older on a Horvath.
Athlete. Oh my gosh, this is a common theme.
On a 15 years younger on a Hannum score. So I'm just befuddled. I'm like, I don't understand how that could be. How did this happen? So doesn't it normally happen that if you're aren't these things all correlated? Like, if you're doing poorly in one area, then you're going to do poorly everywhere?
this is exactly what I was talking about and why I think it's so important that we do studies where we compare different clocks with lifestyle intervention in different populations, like even athletes. So I don't have an answer for your specific question, like athletes, why they are older on one clock. But my assumption is that there are some epigenetic changes, right? That, for example, reflect athletes trigger a lot of hormesis, right? They make damage, they trigger, they produce damage while exercising. And this damage actually is used by your cell to trigger a positive adaptation that right. eventually make you live longer. But probably if you are measuring like just the steady state of your epigenome, probably after exercise, the readout may be an increased oxidative damage, mm-hmm. an increased damage signal that perhaps is captured by the clock as an aging signal, because the original clocks that were trained against chronological age are trained against recognizing oxidative damage as an aging signal. And so that's why I think we are just scratching the surface of biological clocks in epigenetics, because we do need to develop different, more precise clocks for precise outcomes and populations. Otherwise, it's not going to be clinically useful.
Yes, that makes some good sense to me. Let's go right on to the lifestyle changes and what we understand about these things so far from the science. So I know that you're studying low fat versus low carb, because I get this all the time. And I know that some of the studies you're looking at is like, what genetic predispositions do we have that make us more suitable for one or the other? Because that's the only thing that could potentially add more value to my patients or to the viewers to understand which way should they go. So do we know that at all? Like, do we have any further insight?
Unfortunately not. So first of all, let me say that yes, genes can modulate the way we respond to nutrients, and this is called nutrient genetics. However, the genetic effects on your response to food is polygenic. So there are many genes that do this job, and so testing 1, 10, or 100 genes probably is not going to give you any accurate prediction. For example, we did test in our study 3 genes that were had been shown previously to predict whether somebody was more likely to respond to a low-fat and low-carbohydrate diet, but we could not validate those previous reports in our cohort. And the reason is that probably we just tested 3 genes. That's not enough. And also, I think our study just demonstrates that genetic is only one component to assess clinically when estimating your nutrition predispositions. You need to assess other functional markers, your diet, your habits, to come then to a more accurate prediction. And this is called precision medicine. So for example, for your carbohydrate tolerance, we know that yes, there are a bunch of genes that can indicate that, but then there are other metabolic markers that can be actually an indication of your carbohydrate threshold. This is called palmitoleic acid is actually one of these markers. It is produced when we actually eat carbohydrates as a first marker of de novo lipogenesis from carbohydrates. And it turns out that, for example, if your palmitoleic acid spikes up after you eat carbohydrates, yeah, you may have a lower carbohydrate threshold. And then, you know, the powerful of combining your genetics, your genetic predispositions are just the starting line in your health journey. What you start with those predispositions, but then you modify that with your lifestyle. And so there are so other markers, including metabolic markers and epigenetic markers, I'm working on some of them, that can explain how your life history, eating history and life exposures, exercise, have changed your epigenetic, have interacted with your genetic background to actually make who you are now. And so that's what I call precision medicine, is the integration of nutrigenetics, nutrigenomics, and other lifestyle omics to really individually and granularly characterize every single patient and target lifestyle intervention to their needs.
So is there a way, so you're saying we can't just look at the genes because it's, you know, probably 10, 15, 20, whatever, how many genes there are, and they're all having various interplay. So do you think we're ever going to be able to understand that, or we'll have to go at a higher level at the epigenetic level or proteomics, or what do you think?
I think, I'm actually a believer we should just start already implementing some nutrigenetic in clinically, and that's part of my current work. But just genetics will never be a standalone predictor. So we can start small by including, so what I'm doing now, I'm trying to really review all the clinical literature on which genetic variants have been associated with which outcomes in the context of studies that have tested the response to specific diets or lifestyle interventions in the clinic, in people, because this is also important. The information that you see out there on the internet about genetic association has no systematic review behind it. So when I read that information, I don't know whether it comes from an animal study, a human study. In human studies, it's an observational study, just in a bunch of people with no intervention, or it's a clinical trial. We need, first of all, that to really rank and give an evidence score for each genetic association in order to implement that in the clinic. So this is the first step. I do believe, so to answer your question, I do believe we can do that, and I'm already working on this because I think it's an important tool for clinicians and patients to see what their predisposition are, and just as a tool to pinpoint potential intervention needs, potential. And then once you pinpoint that and integrate with functional markers to see whether actually those associations are present or not, then that's the power. So I think we can start. So the first step is seeing what we are, starting where we are now. We already have many studies on genetic interactions, even in the clinic. So let's just focus on them and use that information to validate even further those associations and pick other associations. Mm-hmm. And then the next step will be, as you mentioned, include more genes in so-called polygenic scores. We already are there. In 2018, big studies were published showing that a polygenic score, including I think 6 million SNPs in the genome, was able to predict cardiovascular disease with an accuracy comparable to monogenic mutations, and this is huge. This is just like increasing. So you are clinically, if we implement a tool like that, we'll be able to increase the prediction of patients at risk 20 times. Wow. And it's just like huge. So the second step is going to polygenic score, yes, including more genes. And then the third step is really integrating genetics with multi-omics, epigenetics, and other omics. So I'm excited. I think we are already on the right path, and we can certainly do that. We will make huge steps forward in the next 5-10 years, I'm sure.
It sounds like that. I mean, this polygenic score requires a huge, massive supercomputer. This is not simple. This is not something that can be just by one brain or whatever. This is something that requires massive data to look at the various interactions. And I know right now you have these charts which show, okay, they assign a value of 1 per gene, like they might look at 7 genes, look at diabetes. So, okay, you're positive, you have 5 variations, 5 out of 7, but that's assuming that each one has an equal contribution. But it's probably not like that.
No, in the score, actually, the variants are weighted based on their assumed weight of significance in association studies. But I just want to say, okay, you are right. This is huge. This is perhaps, it does require a ton of data, but we do have access now to huge data sets and biobanks. Mm-hmm. So what I envision for the future is that we may just come with some candidate polygenic score, like the one for cardiovascular disease, based on these association studies. And then have clinicians like you that then test these polygenic scores in the clinic, in real world clinical setting, with a granular information about other biomarkers, functional biomarkers, and these will advance the field.
Wow. Okay. So just how much of it is reversible? Like, let's say they're watching this, say, look, I haven't taken care that much the last 20 years, and I'm interested, but now is it too late for me? How much of this epigenetic changes are reversible?
Yeah, so I actually now can give you an accurate estimate on how quickly you can reverse those epigenetic marks with lifestyle, because just recently a study was published, I think a couple of weeks ago, by Cara Fitzgerald and Moshe Ziff, and they showed that with a lifestyle intervention involving basically a nutrient-dense diet, and intermittent fasting and stress reduction, you can basically become 2 years epigenetically younger in just 8 weeks.
And that's an incredible thing when I saw that. But they used this Horvath clock, no?
They did use, and I'm amazed. I don't know how. I mean, I think I think this is a pilot study. It was in I think 40 people. It's a small study. I'm just excited by the potential. I can tell you that there have been already many studies showing the reversibility of epigenetic changes. There are studies done in obese people that after bariatric surgery can revert their epigenetic marks to the lean type. There are studies done in smokers that showing that smoking associated epigenetic marks can be reverted, although it takes apparently 16 years.
We're told 15 years in medical school that this would take 15 years to revert back.
Yes, exactly, exactly.
Maybe so, that's on epigenetics. It makes complete
sense. But we do have many hints that these changes can be reverted. And even in our study, we see a ton of changes in the epigenetic marks. And also, we look at some epigenetic marks of diabetes, and they revert after lifestyle intervention. So, this is not the first study showing that. I was excited to see that this was a short study with lifestyle intervention and looking at biological age. But there are many, many hints that we can revert things in the positive direction.
So isn't there a limit? Like, physically, we still are aging. And so I just wanted to get your thoughts on that. Like, what do you think? Do we think we'll be able to have an answer to actually, you know, like actually like almost stop our aging? Do you think that's possible? Like, we look at DNA epigenetic changing. Can we stop epigenetic modifications?
This is interesting. We can already do that in vitro. We can, through epigenetic reprogramming, we can take a cell and then give the cell a cocktail of reprogramming factors, and then reprogram that cell, actually turn back the clock epigenetically and reprogram that cell to an induced pluripotent stem cell. We can do that. And we can even only just transiently reprogram that cell in vitro so that it doesn't become a stem cell, but it just rejuvenates. We can rejuvenate in vitro a cell with a cocktail of reprogramming factors. We can already do that. This is called direct reprogramming or transient reprogramming. And we can even do a so-called transdifferentiation, which means we are not actually touching the biological age, but we are just turning a cell into another, skin cells into brain cells, without changing biological age. This just to say, we can precisely manipulate cell identity and biological age independently in vitro. I mean, this is huge. So we can do the possible. I mean, scientifically, it is possible. Now, with lifestyle, I think the concept of longevity medicine is this, is of incremental and synergistic strategy to enhance first health span, to focus on health span, and ultimately of lifespan. So what I think it's, we should really more think in terms of horizons for longevity medicine. So horizon one is probably just increase health span, and in the process, perhaps extending also lifespan by implementing, by focusing on lifestyle and, you know, just leveraging what we already have, the discovery we already have in the field. And we already see that people are living longer, healthier. And then I think the horizon two and three will require incremental involvement with the multiple interventions and more high risk interventions first tested for some diseases, because of course in medicine the first principle is do not harm, so we want to test those high risk interventions with people that perhaps can benefit more, and then extend to more people. So I am very, very excited for the field overall.
Yeah, it's such an exciting time, and thank you so much. Where can people go to learn more about the work you're doing?
Yeah, so I'm not huge on social media. I do have a website, draronica.com. I just post there some links to my courses. I do teach a class on the biology of longevity with another Italian, Maddalena Adorno. She's a CEO working on a company for senolytics. So compounds that kill senescent cells. But anyway, so draronica.com, you can contact me there. There's my email address, there's some information about my publications or on LinkedIn and social media. LinkedIn is a good resource. And these meetings like this one, I love networking with clinicians. For promoting studies in the field.
This is great. I can't wait to watch your work as time goes on, and have you back on my show. So we'll talk to you soon. Thank you very much, Lucia.
Thank you very much for having me.